This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to talk with the editors of two newspapers about their presidential endorsements. A little later we'll hear about the Chicago Tribune's endorsement of President Bush. The Philadelphia Inquirer is doing something unprecedented in its endorsement of John Kerry. It's publishing 21 editorials over 21 days in a series called 21 Reasons to Vote for Kerry. Each editorial expands on the differences between Kerry and Bush in one area, ranging from Homeland Security to Head Start. Opposite the editorial, on the commentary page each day, is a piece by a guest writer who supports Bush. My guests are Chris Sotulo, the editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and John Timpane, the editor of the commentary page. I asked Chris Sotulo if the editorial board wanted to emphasize its endorsement with a 21-day series because Philadelphia is in a swing state.
Very clearly, one reason why we did this is we know Pennsylvania is a close battleground state, and we know that it's quite likely that that battleground will be decided in the suburbs of Philadelphia, where we circulate, where we're the dominant newspaper, and where we think we have some of our most loyal readers who know us and know how we argue points and might actually be interested in our reasoning. You know, the point of an endorsement really is not just naming a name. It's the argument you make, you know, yes. The facts you marshal, the way you interpret them. And nobody votes for a president simply because a newspaper says that. But what we do is we enter the larger conversation. We give people some things to think about. We maybe reframe some issues for them, give them some facts they didn't know before, and that enters into their thinking. We don't think anybody is going to change their mind because we endorse somebody.
Now, the fact that the Philadelphia Inquirer is running 21 days of editorials in support of John Kerry is just half of the story. The other half of the story is on each of those 21 days, you're running a commentary on the commentary page, taking the opposite point of view and supporting President Bush. John Timpane, you edit those commentaries. Why did you decide, and how did you decide at the Inquirer to have each day of the editorial opposed with a commentary?
Well, we decided it at the very moment that we decided to do the first 21-part series. We said, well, we can't just say, yay, Kerry, every day. We should balance it on the op-ed page. And after all, the words op-ed mean opposite to the editorial position. So we went out and we tried to find the very best writers that we could for the conservative rebuttal.
Now, what are your criteria for the very best? I mean, we're living in a time when a lot of people think the very best are the people who, like, spin most convincingly. So what were you looking for in terms of, like, factual background, expertise, spin? You know, like, what were your criteria?
My main criterion was who has written excellently about this in the past for the conservative side. So, for example, who would counter our big editorial against the war in Iraq? Well, I felt David Frum was the best person because he has written a book with Richard Pearl about putting forward very eloquently, as well as you could do it, the case for the war in Iraq, the case for unilateral military action. And so in David's case, he was one of the first people we called. When the issue came up of Kerry's values, who's the best person to write about values? Well, I thought Bill Bennett, despite his recent troubles, I thought he's still a very eloquent spokesperson for conservative values. When we get to Homeland Security, why not have Tom Ridge? For one thing, he used to be our governor. For another thing, he's got standing. He knows, or he should know, what his agency is doing. So it had to do with who had already established a track record as a very good spokesperson for this.
What's the fact-checking like? Like, say somebody makes a statement that you know is pure spin and it's not really true. Are you going to say, you can't really say this because it's not factually accurate, it's just spin?
Yes. Yeah, I've done it an awful lot already. I've done it, you know, 20, 30 times. I've called people back and said, you know, we already know this isn't true.
Give me an example of one of those commentaries.
Well, I don't want to name the writer.
Sure.
But one of the writers tried to say that Kerry has already been discredited for his service in Vietnam. He has not been. And so I said, you can't say that. We had a fight about it, and we won.
I want to add that in terms of writing commentaries, we give leeway to interpret and characterize facts to the writers so that they can make their case.
Sure.
And nothing goes in with their name on it if they don't feel that their case has been made, even if they aren't totally happy. And in the editing of the editorials get bounced back to the writers. And I tell them,
absolutely,
we can't say that. We haven't nailed that. That point doesn't make sense. Where's your where's your source on that? What's your information on that?
I think there's a difference between irresponsible bloviation and being very opinionated. And I want my op-ed writers to be very opinionated. They have every right to feel that with the Inquirer's weight behind a 21-part series for John Kerry, they have every right to feel that they should have a big stage in which to air their grievances. But I don't want them to lie. And, we don't want any lies anywhere in the newspaper.
Now, you want your 21 editorials to really carry a lot of weight and to help inform your readers before going to the polls. I'm wondering if the Kerry Edwards campaign has quoted any of the editorials in their ads or in their literature.
Not that I'm aware of. I've seen that they've posted them on their blog. One thing I just want to make real clear to everyone is we had no communication with the Kerry Edwards campaign before or during this project. We haven't talked to them to get any information. We're doing our own reporting.
Absolutely.
And our own writing. There's just absolutely no connection with the Kerry campaign whatsoever.
I mean, ironically, I've had a lot of connection with the Bush-Cheney campaign and certainly, involving the displeasure and discomfort of certain parties.
We've had some very entertaining conversations.
Well, we're about to get to that. And let me ask you about the letters that you've been receiving. The editorials, the 21 days of editorials is unprecedented. Is the nature of the letters that you're getting unprecedented as well?
We've received, at a certain point you stop counting, but at least 1,500 responses to the series by email, letters, or phone calls, probably running 3-1 against the initial.
Against your editorials?
I hesitate to say against the editorials, against the idea of the project. I have to say that it seems to me that very, very few of the people who are writing in have even actually seen the newspaper. Yeah. What happened was the Bush-Cheney campaign put out an email to its mailing list, which told people that we were doing this horrible, horrible, illegitimate thing, and mentioned only that we were writing the 21 editorials and never mentioned the 21 rejoinders from Bush supporters.
Right.
It was an extremely unfair and unbalanced description of what we were doing, and a lot of the email we're getting from around the country clearly is a response to that distortion.
Bush-Cheney actually have been cooperating with me and getting some of the pieces. All the time that they have been doing this other campaign, they've been working with us to get pieces on the page. So it's a rather ironic.
So in other words, if you want somebody high-powered within the Bush-Cheney camp, they'll help you get them.
Absolutely, with bells on, yes.
Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. I called someone with the Bush-Cheney campaign to try in a somewhat good-natured way. I called up and said, hello, it's the Antichrist. Also, it's Chris Satul. I just asked, do you really think it's fair to send out this email to all these people and not mention that you're working with us on the rebuttal pieces? And the reply of the person in the Bush-Cheney campaign was, it's not my job to be fair. It's my job to reelect the president of the United States.
What does that tell you about the political process?
Well, he's right. I mean, that is his job.
Yeah.
That didn't tell us anything we didn't know. It's when it's done to you that it wakes you up a little bit, and it's been done us.
Right. I have these shreds of naive idealism, which after 30 years of covering politics, I should have scoured away. And I'm sure, people on the other side would be as intent on discrediting what we're doing had we endorsed President Bush. But I don't want to leave the impression that many of our ordinary readers didn't write in. They did write in. Some of them were extremely unhappy. Some of them were very happy. We had a couple of people calling up nearly in tears. I mean, we've had praising us, saying, finally a newspaper with guts. Now, they're very much outnumbered by our readers who are unhappy and saw that as a piece of a long history of partisan bias or liberal bias in the entire newspaper. The other point I'd just like to make is that normally our editorial page is centrist. When we endorse in congressional races, we're pretty much split down the middle, Republican mm-hmm. and Democrat. We've supported things like school vouchers, moment of silence in schools. We try to take a fresh and non-ideological and unpredictable look at a lot of issues. This particular president, this particular campaign has left us feeling that it's much more important to make sure that the hard right revolution that is occurring isn't completed than it is to be perfectly centrist. So at times we find ourselves aligned in this election or sounding like very liberal elements of the Democratic Party who, in a normal period of time, we would be criticizing fairly strongly.
Well, I think so many newspaper readers are really confused. How can it be that you can say the reporters are unbiased in their coverage, that there's an editorial page that is all about offering opinion?
Terry, I think you're on to a really great point, which is that people in the newspaper business seem to think that everybody understands what we're doing, even though we never bothered to explain it. Even the very term editorial board is confusing because it sounds like we're running the newspaper. That's what it sounds like an editorial board does. I've come to the conclusion that after this is done, whenever this election is decided, December, January, whenever we find out who's won, when the dust clears, I think we're going to change the name of the editorial page and the editorial board because I think it's deeply confusing to people and the tradition is not worth the confusion. I think we should call it the opinion page and I think we should call it the opinion board, and that would make what we do as opposed to what the news side reporters and editors do much clearer to people.
Now, what about the publisher? You're part of the Knight Ridder chain. Mm-hmm. Can the publisher ever intervene and say, I don't like the idea of you doing 21 editorials endorsing John Kerry, or I don't like the op-eds you've been running. Those opinion pieces aren't strong enough. Mm. Here's my list of people who I think would be stronger. Print them. Does the publisher ever intervene like that?
Technically, and again, this is one of these mysteries of the news business that we don't explain very well, but the editorial page is the publisher's page. He is actually the chair of the editorial board at our paper and at most papers. So he has every right to do whatever he wants. But in my 10 years on the editorial board at the Inquirer, it has never happened that the publisher has countermanded a decision of the board. They take part in the discussion sometimes, some of the higher profile things, and they have their say. In this case, Joe Natoli, our publisher, approved the project. I wouldn't ever do something like this without reviewing it with him. His emphasis from day one and all the way through has been, what are we doing for balance? But he's behind the series 100%.
Now, the publisher has to worry about the bottom line. What kind of impact, if any, do you think your 21 days of endorsements for Kerry have been getting from subscribers, newsstand buyers, and advertisers?
I think the latest number of people who've called to threaten to cancel their subscription as opposed to actually following through with it is around 600 to 700, which is not something you take lightly in this world of newspapers where we're fighting every year to increase circulation slightly or to stay even. But the publisher and the people on the business side of the paper know this is part of what a newspaper is and does, and mm-hmm. it's part of being a strong voice in the community. And in the end, they realize that the stronger a voice we have, the more effective we are at grabbing our community's attention and holding it, the better the newspaper is. It's no fun talking to people, and I've called a lot of them and talked to them. Mm-hmm. It is no fun talking to people who feel this badly about something you've done that they're thinking of breaking what is in some cases a 30 or 40 year relationship with you as a reader. But if we'd endorsed George Bush, an equal or perhaps greater number of people would have canceled.
My guests are Chris Sotulo, editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and John Tim Payne, editor of the Commentary Page. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Chris Sotulo, editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and John Tim Payne, editor of the Commentary Page. The paper is running a series of 21 editorials, each offering another reason to vote for Kerry. During this election, and for the past few years, really, there have been charges that newspapers that have always been seen as pretty mainstream and TV networks that have been seen as pretty mainstream are actually really liberal. And this kind of charge is being leveled at news coverage at a lot of newspapers, not just the editorial page. So how is that affecting the Philadelphia Inquirer?
We get that charge all the time, and it is not without substance. More and more, as I get further into this job and spend more and more of my time exchanging emails and talking to conservatives who make this complaint, I see what it is about newspapers that drives them crazy over their cornflakes in the morning. I do see lapses in fairness or understanding or perspective more often than I used to. What frustrates me about this conversation is that it is true that we need to sit back, we being journalists, sit back and do a reassessment to make sure that we haven't gotten into some reflexes and some bad habits that really are unfair to our readership. But most of the complaints about bias that I hear assume a kind of partisan ideological agenda on the part of newspapers. And that's why I think that argument falls on deaf ears so often, because if you work in a newspaper, you know that it's some of the most skeptical, non-ideological people in the world tend to gravitate towards journalism. There is no way in which we sit around a big oak table in the morning and say, okay, how can we slant the news to help the Democrats? I mean, that simply doesn't happen. But that's the way the charge of bias is frequently framed. So it's very easy to say, oh, we're not doing that, so we're fine. We probably aren't doing what our critics are saying, but that doesn't mean that we're fine. We're still making mistakes.
What are the mistakes?
I think it's a failure of perspective. If you take an issue like gay marriage, Dan Okren, who's the public editor for the New York Times, wrote a wonderful piece saying that the New York Times, when the issue of gay marriage was hot, when the weddings were happening in San Francisco and Boston, I don't have the exact numbers, wrote something like 55 pieces about the issue. And only three of those pieces spent much time talking about the possibility that this wasn't a good thing for America. Most of them were celebratory in sort of their tone or their approach to the news. That's clearly not balanced coverage when you know that a certain segment of your readership thinks this is really a terrible development. And I'm not making a comment one way or another on gay marriage, but if you're covering an issue of controversy like that, it's clear that you have to make sure that you have some sympathetic understanding of the perspective that says what's happening in Massachusetts and San Francisco is bad for the country.
Chris Atullo, in Sunday's paper, you had a column in which you were talking about the expression the liberal elite.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about how, although you're from a working class town in or suburb in Ohio, because of the work that you do now, you would be, in this narrative, described as part of the liberal media elite.
Right.
What's going on there, do you think, with that expression? How is that expression being used now, and why do you distrust it?
There is a conservative narrative that's been growing for 30 years in the country that basically explains what's gone wrong with the country and how it's gone right. And in this narrative, what's gone wrong with the country is the media and the levers of government were essentially subject to a hostile takeover by an arrogant liberal elite that involves people that go to colleges in mostly New England, who are very cosmopolitan in outlook, have a kind of sneering contempt for the values of mainstream America. Think NASCAR is stupid, think country music is stupid. They come out of the 60s, they devoted their time in the 60s to sex, drugs, and Led Zeppelin and draft dodging. You know, this whole narrative. So every time I write something that's critical of President Bush, which is, I admit, not been an infrequent occurrence this year, I get email where people say, well, we know who you are, and here's why we can dismiss everything you have to say. You're part of this elite that's immoral, that doesn't believe in God. Parenthetical mention, I'm an Episcopalian, but they're sure I'm an atheist. They're sure that I spent most of the 1960s on mescaline and LSD. They're sure of all these things. And it's a way of not really dealing with what I might have to say or in anything, you know, any argument I make that has some substance, because they can put me over there. I'm part of an elite that is in their mind discredited. You know, and I know lots of these people. They're my neighbors. I still live in the suburbs. I get along great with them when we're not talking about politics, when we're watching football or playing golf or having a cookout. So I realize that this is not fully part of their attitude. It's just something they use as a defense mechanism when it's politics is what the question is.
Do you feel that the Bush campaign is using this narrative?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a narrative that has worked politically for the Republican Party for a long time. It speaks to something real, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not that there isn't an arrogant liberal elite, and it's not that there aren't people who are contemptuous of mainstream American values. So they have something real that they can plug into. And I think President Bush, with his kind of studied inarticulateness, his mangled syntax, his swagger, his work shirts, the way he talks about John Kerry, you know, Massachusetts liberal, is plugging into that.
And finally, do you think that there will be contested votes on Election Day in the area that you cover, in the greater Philadelphia area, the Delaware Valley?
I think it's almost a certainty.
I've always said it was a blessing from God that it was Florida that was tied and not Pennsylvania, because I would never want anybody to come in and lift the rock in Philadelphia and see how we actually tally
really, what's
votes there.
What's
especially
the
this town.
What's the problem?
It's Well, as in many cities still, I mean, that there is a system here, and things can get lost if people don't like the way things turn out, and it's but I also think that's true of the state in general. It is not the best organized place as far as collecting the votes and tallying the votes.
Now, this is a Democratic machine town, Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
Our paper several years ago did a major investigation on how Democrats stole a state Senate election doing monkey business with absentee ballots. The election was overturned by a federal judge as a result of our reporting. This may seem hard to believe to people elsewhere, but in Philadelphia there are voting machines in people's living rooms. You go into a private home to vote in places in Philadelphia, and that person is often a Democratic precinct committee person in whose home you're voting. So there's a lot of stuff that happens in Philly that I'd like to see get fixed. I think there are examples of stuff like that all over the country.
You know, I'm praying every day that it's not that close here. I'm praying really hard.
Do you have a prediction about whether it will be?
I do, and it will remain with me.
Very good. And Chris, you feel the same way?
I think it'll be close. I would suspect that Kerry's going to win Pennsylvania because I think there's just going to be enormous turnout in the city of Philadelphia, and a lot of it will actually be valid. There's just a tremendous amount of feeling among minority voters in this city that minority voters were disenfranchised last time. And even if they're not that thrilled about John Kerry, I think that will effectively motivate them.
Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Chris Atullo is the editorial page editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. John Timpane edits the commentary page. We'll hear about the Chicago Tribune's endorsement of President Bush in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.